From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, it's our year-end roundup of movies and pop music. Film critic David Edelstein will talk about the best films of the year and review the movies opening for the holidays. Then rock critic Ken Tucker will play some of his favorite tracks of the year and run through his 10 best list. The first season of the HBO series The Wire is now out on DVD. John Powers has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At an end-of-the-year news conference today, President Bush defended the work of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and said that efforts to train Iraqi security forces have so far met with mixed results. The president also called for bipartisan cooperation from Congress on issues such as Social Security and tax reform. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
In an almost hour-long news conference, the president said one of his top priorities next year will be to change the Social Security system so that younger workers can have their own private accounts. He said that ensuring the solvency of the retirement system will involve difficult choices, but he would not elaborate on what measures he'll propose.
But I'm under no illusions. It's going to take hard work. It's going to take hard work to convince a lot of people, some of whom would rather not deal with the issue.
Reacting to criticism that his defense secretary has not done enough to support U.S. troops, the president called Rumsfeld a caring person and said he's doing a really fine job. The president said that it will take more training before Iraqi forces are ready to take over their country's security. He would not speculate on how long U.S. troops will be needed in Iraq. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
At his news conference today, President Bush also said the White House was not at fault for failing to uncover problems that led to the withdrawal of Homeland Security nominee Bernard Kerik. The former New York City police commissioner withdrew after disclosing that he failed to pay employment taxes for a nanny who may have been in the country illegally. Critics have said the White House vetting process should have found that and other problems. The president said he's still looking for a new nominee.
I'm going to find somebody who knows something about intelligence. and capable and honest and ready to do the job.
The president told reporters that the Kerik nomination didn't result in any lessons for the White House vetting process because the lesson was to ask questions, and his staff did that. Navy Secretary Gordon England says that a military review has determined that a second prisoner being held at Guantanamo Bay should not be classified as an enemy combatant. That means the prisoner will be released. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
This is the second time that the military has determined that a prisoner was wrongly classified. Navy Secretary England, who would not identify the prisoner by name or nationality, says the State Department now will arrange to return him to his home. England says another 200 Guantanamo prisoners have been released under other mechanisms. Of those, he says at least 12 have resumed activities designed to undermine or harm the United States. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 11 points to close at 10,661 in heavy trading of more than 1.4 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 7 points to 2127. This is NPR News. Iraq's interim prime minister is blaming Sunni Muslim insurgents for yesterday's deadly bombings in the Shiite holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. Car bombs in the two cities killed more than 60 people. Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said the attacks are aimed at stopping the national elections set for next month and at fomenting a civil war between the two Muslim sects. An appeals court in Chile upheld the indictment and house arrest of former dictator Augusto Pinochet. He's charged for his alleged role in a 1970s plan by South American dictatorships to kill leftist dissidents. Maria Paz Hermosilla reports from Santiago.
The court unanimously rejected the appeal presented last week by Pinochet's defense after Judge Juan Guzman indicted him for human rights abuses. This is the first time a case against Pinochet proceeds to upper courts without dismissing the charges against him. Pinochet's defense appealed immediately to the Supreme Court.
La Corte de Apelaciones ha pasado por encima de la Constitución.
Defense attorney Pablo Rodriguez says the appeals court ruling doesn't respect Pinochet's constitutional rights or the international treaties signed by Chile. General Pinochet remains hospitalized in stable condition after suffering a stroke last Saturday that left him unconscious. For NPR News, I'm Maria Paz Hermosilla in Santiago.
There was a sign today that the economy could be improving in the next 3 to 6 months. The conference board said its index of leading economic indicators gained 0.2% in November. It was the first gain for the index after 5 straight months of declines. The private research group said its data shows the economy could slow down in the next few months, but that doesn't mean that the economic expansion is coming to an end. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's a Fresh Air tradition this time of year to invite our film critic and rock critic to talk about their 10 best lists. Let's start with our film critic, David Edelstein, who also has some thoughts about the new movies opening for the holidays. David is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. David, happy holidays. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with holiday movies. What type of movies tend to get released around the holidays?
Well, normally they're the movies that, in contrast to, say, the summer movies, are the ones that the studios think have a chance to win big awards for the directors and the actors. This year, it's funny, just one after another, even the ones you think are going to be fun are grim. You've got, you know, all sorts of themes of madness and obsession and genocide and euthanasia and you know, even the ones that you know, start out as comedies or as sports movies have kind of tragic deaths in the middle of it. I don't know what it is.
Well, why don't we start with Martin Scorsese's movie, The Aviator, which is about
Good
Howard
choice.
Hughes. What do you think?
Well, you know, I have a problem in general with biopics. I tend to think those movies are very spread out and they're full of cliches. But the amazing thing about The Aviator is it's 3 hours. It covers a guy who was a lot of things. He was a daring pilot. He was a kind of hard-charging capitalist. He was an innovator. He was a romancer of gorgeous Hollywood stars. He was a target of congressional investigations. He was an obsessive-compulsive germaphobe who, as we all know, went mad. And this movie is absolutely seamless. It all fits together. The guy fits together. The movie fits together. Scorsese and his genius editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, and for that matter, John Logan, who wrote the script, they are just absolute wizards of transitions. And it's just pure pleasure. It's 3 hours of pure pleasure. It's very buoyant, and at the same time, you know, it gives you a lot to chew over when it's over. And Leo DiCaprio is, well, I think he's a really wonderful actor. He's maybe a little lightweight for Howard Hughes, but he gets the drive, he gets the momentum of the part. And I just want to mention a performance by Cate Blanchett as Katharine Hepburn that is so delightful. She made me see Hepburn with new eyes. She's very jaunty and she's incredibly high-strung at the same time. And I never realized that really defines Katharine Hepburn. It's one of those caricatures that makes you appreciate the real thing.
I've been looking forward to seeing Wes Anderson's movie, The Life Aquatic. I loved his previous film. What did you think of the new one?
Well, this is a disclaimer. I'm not someone who gets down on his knees to young Wes. But this is an attempt to get at, to use his sort of precious style to get at some really big themes. About the dream life of the artist and his relationship to the real world. And I really admire the ambition, the reach of this movie, not to mention that it's just it's a gorgeous, kind of unabashedly silly toy box of a movie with beautiful colors and with frames that make you laugh out loud. It is a mess. I still think Anderson often upstages his actors with his amazing designs. And I think it's a mistake to go tragic and bring in real violence and death, although I admit that that's one of the themes of the movie.
Now, the new film Spanglish was directed by James Brooks, who's given us a lot of good things. Why don't you run through some of the James Brooks things?
I don't know. Terms of Endearment kind of made my head hurt.
Oh, that wasn't on my list of the good things.
Oh, okay. And As Good as It Gets, I thought was emotional pornography, you know, with the kid, the sick kid, and the gay guy getting beaten up. And I don't know. I actually am not I'm a huge fan of his TV work, but I loved Spanglish. In contrast to the Scorsese, which I said was sort of miraculously fluid, this movie is very shapeless. It's longish. Spanglish is longish. But it's really about something. It takes off from the language and the class divide between this Mexican maid who doesn't speak any English, at least at the beginning, and a very wealthy Beverly Hills family, in which the mother, who's played by Taya Leone in just a terrifically funny performance. The mother is a proud liberal, but she's also a kind of neurotic basket case who patronizes this maid and who, in a very intriguing twist, virtually adopts the maid's daughter and buys her clothes and sets her on her way as a successful American to the point where it really becomes a threat to the maid. There's a lot wrong with this film. There's a lot of little things that kind of niggle at you. And it's a little disconcerting that the actress who plays the maid, she's a Spanish actress named Paz Vega, she's just so jaw-droppingly beautiful that even the characters in the movie commented. And I saw this movie at a sneak preview, you know, with real people. And in some shots, members of the audience literally gasped at her beauty. And I suppose that sort of lifts it into the realm of fairy tale when a lot of it feels very real. But I love the feel of the movie, and there are so many moments of discovery in it. I really hope it doesn't bomb.
Clint Eastwood has a new movie, Million Dollar Baby, that he directed and stars in, and it's only opening in a couple of cities like New York and L.A. I guess that's for Academy Award consideration, and apparently it will be considered because some critics are already talking about it as the best film of the year.
He is beloved among certain critics, who have compared him to Hemingway and, God help us, Shakespeare, and think he's, you know, the sort of major living American director. I feel a little naughty saying that this is an extremely crude and obvious melodrama dressed up in kind of moody is his signature, moody art house clothes. It starts out as a cliched but soft-pedaled go-for-it boxing movie with this gruff coach played by Eastwood and the plucky young upstart played by Hilary Swank. And then it sucker punches you with pure tragedy. But as usual with Eastwood, I think the fatalism is laid on with a trowel, and the handling of some of the supporting characters is just unbelievably crude. It's a great mystery to me why critics are labeling this movie the best of the year.
My guest is David Edelstein. We're talking about some of the films opening for the holidays, and in just a few minutes we'll also hear his 10 best lists and review the year in film. One of the movies opening for the holidays is Phantom of the Opera. You've seen it. How is it?
Maybe the single most excruciating 2.5 hours I have ever spent in a theater. I would have left after 20 minutes if Fresh Air weren't paying me the big bucks. I know some people adore Andrew Lloyd Webber. It's one of the great mysteries of existence. I think the melodies are awful when they're not just downright derivative, and even the good ones are never developed. And the movie itself is just, puts those melodies kind of on a pedestal. And I'm sorry, it's just schlock. I mean, it's oppressively static because The tunes are so repetitive and the lyrics are so simple-minded. When I was watching it, it really made me appreciate how the great operas work as drama. They're actually very sophisticated dramas. This one's not. As a movie, it's upsetting. You know, when I was a kid, I bought this Super 8 Black Hawk Films copy of the entire Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera, and it's great. You know, in the end, the heroes go through this passageway, and they meet one obstacle after another, and they end up in torture chambers and drowning and up on hooks. And it's you think that a movie of this could be so cinematic, but Andrew Lloyd Webber is so damn wedded to every syllable of his musical. You know, none of this is in the movie. It's just, as I said, it's just very static.
Well, when we started, you said that this holiday season of movies is largely about subjects very grim, including genocide, which leads us to the final movie on the holiday movie list, which is Hotel Rwanda.
Hotel Rwanda.
Yeah. So, does the movie work in trying to describe? I don't know how descriptive it is of the genocide. I know it's about a hotel owner who gives shelter to a lot of people in his hotel.
Well, it can't show you the entire scope of the Rwandan genocide, which, as we know, killed close to 1 million people. It's not a great movie, but I think it is an important one. It has a great performance by Don Cheadle as this obsequious, almost westernized Hutu hotel manager who shelters the Tutsis, including his wife, in this kind of Western luxury hotel. And for the entire movie, he has to negotiate constantly to keep them from being taken out and shot. And along the way, he has to run and get food, and he has to run and try to enlist the help of various corrupt generals and kind of helpless diplomats. And, you know, he passes the piles of bodies, the women and the children, just sort of hacked down with machetes. And you know, we all heard about the Rwandan genocide, but it's kind of important to have a movie that actually puts those images on the screen. I hate to say it.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein. We'll talk about his list of the best movies of the year after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic. One of my favorite parts of the end of the year is seeing everybody's 10 best list. David, you've brought your 10 best films of the year list. So this is the dramatic part.
Well, can I preface it?
Yes.
Can I preface it?
Yes.
Can I add yet another disclaimer? In making my 10 best list this year, I really only came up with 7 movies that I absolutely could say these are the best of the year, and then sort of a long list of movies that I also want you to see. You know, a good 10 best list has one blockbuster, you know, to prove that you're not out of sync with the mass audience. And it really should have one film that nobody's ever heard of to prove you're superior to the mass audience. So it's an art form in and of itself. So here goes. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, number one, by a wide margin, is Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry's masterpiece, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Number two, Alexander Payne's comedy, Sideways. Number three is kind of a tie between Hero and House of Flying Daggers. They're two Zhang Yimou martial arts masterpieces. A reader of mine calls this the martial artsy genre. Number four, Pedro Almodovar's Bad Education, which is his third, I think, great film in a row. Number five, Brad Bird's The Incredibles, which lives up to its name. And number six, Jonathan Coet's home movie essay on his family's and his own madness, Tarnation. My other favorites this year, in no order.
Wait, you said there were seven.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hero and House of Flying Daggers.
Oh, that's two. Yes, that's right.
I cheat, you know, I cheat, so now I can put in four more. Okay. And among them would be Spanglish, as I mentioned, The Aviator, which I talked about, the two wonderful rock documentaries, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, and End of the Century about the Ramones, a Hong Kong thriller, Infernal Affairs, and a Taiwanese tone poem, this is the obscure one, set in a dying movie house called Goodbye Dragon Inn. There are also two movies about women compelled to commit acts of heroism. Mulade, which is Ousmane Sembe's anti-female circumcision drama, and Vera Drake, which is Mike Leigh's drama of an English cleaning woman who moonlights as an abortionist. And I wanted to add that I initially was somewhat skeptical about that film, but the longer it sits with me, the more I respect Leigh's work and the work of Imelda Staunton, who plays Vera.
Do you feel like the vote for best documentary is that any of the votes for instance the Academy Awards are going to be very politically divisive? You know, will The Passion of the Christ win awards? Will Michael Moore's movie win awards? You know, because some of the films have become so politically charged.
Boy, I find it even hard to open my mouth on The Passion of the Christ. I got so much hate mail for calling it the Jesus Chainsaw Massacre on this very program. Fahrenheit and Passion really highlight our cultural schism, and I don't know. I mean, they might do so out of fear of the reaction from the country if they don't. I know that already certain talk show hosts have begun to fan this flame to say if The Passion of the Christ is not nominated for Best Picture, it will be proof that Hollywood is out of touch with America. In terms of Passion of the Christ and Fahrenheit 9/11, I suppose there might be someone somewhere who loves them both. But in general, I don't think either side will ever see the other's point of view. Each film is in its single-mindedness extremely punishing. And yet, for its intended audience, it's sort of a turn-on. I mean, every bloody lash and gouge in Mel Gibson's Jesus movie is transfiguring for its audience. For them, it can't be too bloody. It can't be too horrific. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, you know, it gives no inkling of Saddam Hussein's brutality or the real peril of what some call Islamofascism. But Moore has a real and very well-developed view of the United States as run by kind of corporatist greed heads who hide their motives behind bogus piety. And he lays it out for us. And it's in the service of attacking a war he really believes is waged by arrogant fools. And you know, this was extremely gratifying to many people who have been hungering for something this strong against this particular administration.
You know, a lot of conservative people have criticized Hollywood for being left-leaning. For the people who you know in the film industry or in the movie criticism business, for those who are, in fact, leaning more to the left than to the right, do you think that they're upset at being at Hollywood being criticized for being liberal?
Sure they do, because most of the time they don't perceive themselves as peddling anything other than secular humanist values. Really, it's only been, I think, in the last 20 years that secular humanist values have been portrayed as, ultra-liberal. I think Hollywood's politics mostly revolve around what's going to manipulate an audience. I had an epiphany about 15 years ago when, within a couple of weeks, the movies Field of Dreams and Dead Poets Society were released. They're movies really coming from kind of opposite ends of the political and cultural spectrum. One of them is about a guy who rejected his dad during the counterculture and, as a result, because his dad was a reactionary conservative. And as a result, there's this great void in his life. And it's about the importance of kind of reconciling yourself to your dad and kind of embracing his values. And the dad comes back as a baseball player, and they have this wonderful reunion, ghostly reunion on a baseball field. And then a week later, Dead Poets Society came out, and it was a classic counterculture movie about daddies who kill. You know, kind of setting the stage for the counterculture, for defeating the daddies who drive sensitive young men to commit suicide. Now, the same critics who loved one movie loved them both, and I realized they didn't really have much different politics. Their politics were all about jerking an audience around. The people who make vigilante movies, probably a lot of them are against capital punishment and even vote Democrat, but they know vigilante movies really turn on an audience. They get you sort of hungering for the bad guy's blood, and they give you a kind of orgasmic payoff at the end. So I think a lot of Hollywood's politics are completely opportunistic.
David, for anyone who's going to have time to get to just one movie over the holidays, is there any particular movie you'd recommend?
Can I give you two?
Yes.
Okay. I would say Alexander Payne's Sideways, which is about two men on a wine tasting trip. It's a marvelous portrait of both addiction and Pinot Noir. And also, of course, House of Flying Daggers, which is just the damnedest thing. It's the most gorgeous martial arts film you'll ever see, worthy of being ranked with the great dance musicals.
Well, David, happy holidays. Thank you so much for talking about movies with us.
Thank you very much. And remember, if the gloom and doom of the holiday season gets to you, rent The Lady Eve or The Shop Around the Corner.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, a new vision of the American forest by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Purple Book, 2005 edition, The Definitive Guide to Exceptional Online Shopping by Hilary Mendelson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hanging down from my window, those are my wind chimes.
Coming up, crunk, punk, pop, and the increasing influence of the iPod. Rock critic Ken Tucker looks back at 2004, plays some of his favorite tracks, and runs through his 10 best list. And critic John Powers recommends watching the entire first season of the HBO series The Wire. It's now out on DVD.
Now and then, a tear rolls off my cheek. Close your eyes and lean back now. Listen to wind chimes. In the late afternoon.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our rock critic Ken Tucker is here to play some of his favorite recordings of the year and run through his 10 best list. Ken is also TV critic for New York Magazine. Ken, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with hip-hop. What's new in hip-hop this year?
Hip-hop this year, I think it's the year of the producer. Producers really came to the forefront both as behind the scenes and as performers. You had this very interesting phenomenon in Georgia. This group, Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, make this music that's called Crunk, which is a kind of combination of the words crazy and drunk with funk kind of thrown into it. But Lil Jon himself has become a very popular in-demand producer to the extent where his music is being produced for mainstream pop acts like Usher. You know, a year or two ago, Usher was just a very mainstream R&B singer, but he got hooked up with Lil Jon and wanted to kind of ride this wave of crunk music and ended up recording this song called Yeah, which is one of Lil Jon's catchphrases. Every song Lil Jon does, he yells, yeah. And it became a number one hit for Usher. So it's a very interesting thing. I'd like to play that song.
Oh, great. Well, let's hear it.
Peace up. A-Town down. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Usher. Lil Jon. Get a little VI, keep it down on the low key. She know how it feels. I started shorty, she was checking up for me. From the game, she was spitting in my ear. You would think that she knew me. Decided to cheat. Conversation got heavy. She had me feeling like she's ready to blow.
Well, that's Usher. Ken, you were saying it's the year of the producer, and the producer of the Usher track that we just heard has his own band.
Yes, Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. They just put out an album called Crunk Juice, which most of which cannot ever be played anywhere near a radio station. Lots of four-letter words, but it's very much against the tide of recent gangsta rap music in the sense that it's not about violence. It's all about partying. It's a much more hedonistic, have a good time kind of music. I find it very repetitive, frankly, but the basic beats to it, I find connect up with that George Clinton, James Brown, very elemental drum beats, synthesizers used as percussion. It's a very interesting style that is basically run into the ground. I'll be very surprised if at the end of 2005, Lil Jon has not faded from the scene. But right now, Crunk Juice is the sound of the moment.
That's Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. My guest is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic. We're reviewing the year in music. Ken, you've been referring to this as the year of the producer in hip-hop. Is there any other producer you want to single out?
Yes, a very prominent one was Kanye West, who had produced a lot of hits for acts like Jay-Z and Ludacris. He put out his own album called College Dropout, and it got more Grammy nominations than any other album this year. So he's another person who's very... coming to the forefront as a performer as well as a behind-the-scenes producer.
I know one of the albums you really liked this year was Green Day. Day's latest, which you've described as a punk opera. Has this been a year where punk has had a lot of influence on current bands?
I think that the resurgence of Green Day, who hadn't put out an album in a few years, and the release of American Idiot really kind of coalesced this idea that there was a lot of punk-influenced music that was around this year. Bands that I really liked, like the Black Keys from Cincinnati, the Hives from Sweden, a lot of them were going back to that very, you know, two or three chords, 3-minute songs, very much in the mode of the Ramones. It was a real harking back to the 70s, and I think with a kind of fresh energy.
You want to play something?
Yeah, I'd like to play the title song from American Idiot, Green Day's album.
That was Green Day, and Ken, you know, we were talking about the influence of punk music on current bands, and this was a sad year for the Ramones, one of the seminal punk bands, but in a way it was an interesting year for their legacy. What happened this year?
Yeah, this was the year that Johnny Ramone died of cancer. He was 55. That follows the death of Joey, also died of cancer in 2001, and Dee Dee Ramone, who OD'd in 2002. Tommy is the only surviving Ramone. There's a really remarkable, I thought very moving documentary that was released this year called End of the Century, The Story of the Ramones, in which Johnny especially was particularly eloquent and poignant about what the band was about. It really, the band was their life, and it was a very ultimately sad story of the way they really thought that they would be the number one band in the country throughout, you know, a 25-year existence, and instead they became kind of the consummate road band that always had a very firm cult following but never quite broke through.
With me is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic, and we're reviewing the year in pop music. We talked a little bit about the influence of punk. What about rock and roll?
I think what we think of as good old-fashioned rock and roll played by, you know, on guitars and drums without a lot of other ornamentation. There are a number of very strong albums, foremost of which I thought was this band Eagles of Death Metal that I liked a lot. The Black Keys out of Cincinnati, and scattered all over the world. I mean, the Hives from Sweden, who sing songs in English, put out their second album. It wasn't quite as strong as the first one last year, but I remember seeing them on David Letterman, and the energy was just absolutely explosive. And the fascinating thing about the TV appearance with David Letterman was Letterman introduced him, and you could tell it was one of those things where Dave kind of maybe knew, and his staff told him he should have this band on. They played this song called Walk Idiot Walk, which to me is a wonderful song that has a kind of elemental, like the Kingsman's Louie Louie kind of riff to it. And they just exploded through this song, and in 2 minutes it was over. And David Letterman got up from his desk, walked over, and he said, "Now that's how you do it. That's the way it's played." And he, like, shook the guy's hand with two hands, which you never see Dave have any physical contact if he possibly can avoid it with any guest, and warmly shook this guy's hand, and he said, "Really, thanks a lot, fellas." He said, "You just blew the roof off this dump." And I felt like, yeah, that's exactly how I feel when I listen to the Hives.
Well, play something for us.
I'd like to play that song, Walk Idiot Walk.
Great.
Well, we'll be right back.
That's The Hives. Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker will run through his 10 best list after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Tucker. He's Fresh Air's rock critic, and he's here to review the year in pop music and play us some of the highlights. What are some of the things that happened this year on the fringes?
It was a good year for fringe music in the sense that you had the greatest fringe artist of all time, perhaps, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, finally, after 30-some-odd years, released Smile. This almost legendary album that he did in 1965, laid down basic tracks for, but then withheld from the public because he basically had a nervous breakdown at that point. But with his longtime collaborator, Van Dyke Parks, he very painstakingly reassembled, re-recorded Smile from scratch. And it's very interesting to hear now because this is not, retrieved old 35-year-old tracks. This is a newly recorded version of Smile. So Brian Wilson's voice is scratchier, deeper, more kind of damaged in a way. But it's very interesting to hear him sing songs that we're very familiar with, like the song I'd like to play, Surf's Up.
A diamond necklace plays upon hand in hand, some drums along wall to a handsome man in the charm. Up line class aristocracy, back through the opera glass, you see the pit and the pendulum draw. My God, my God. Colonnaded ruins, domino. Canvas the town and brush the backdrop. Are you sleeping?
That's Brian Wilson from Smile. Ken, what about a younger newcomer, kind of people on the fringe?
Yeah, there was a very wide range of people who didn't kind of fit into any categories. There was this young woman named Nellie Mackay who put out a double album, which is kind of unusual for a new young artist these days. And she's influenced. She says she's influenced by, you know, everything from the Beatles to Doris Day songs. And at first, I found her terribly precious. She has this. She wears her hair in a bob and affects these kind of 50s clothes, and I thought she was terribly mannered. But then the more and more I listened to these songs, I thought she was a very strong singer-songwriter. And it's unusual for a major label like Columbia to get behind an act like that. There's a sister duo called Tegan and Sarah who put out a really good album called So Jealous. Sort of the annoying commercial hook that they're sold by is that they are identical twin sister who also happen to be lesbians. A dubious commercial hook, to be sure. But the album, So Jealous, is really terrific. And previously, they'd done primarily folk music, and they added a lot more rock and roll elements to this music, which made it a lot more quirky. Another band that I really liked is a group called Fiery Furnaces, which is composed of a brother and sister, Eleanor and Matthew Friedberger. And they put out this very difficult album in a certain sense called Burberry Boat. A lot of the tracks were 8 or 10 minutes long. Rolling Stone described them as trying to rewrite Finnegan's Wake for rock and roll, which I thought was rather stupid of Rolling Stone because the songs are very long and leisurely. To me, they reminded me of the poetry of John Ashbery, very kind of imagery that's kind of fragmented, just making on the verge of making sense a lot of the time. But to me, it was the most poetic album of the year.
Is there anybody you'd like to play for us from the New Fringe?
Yeah, there's a Scottish band called Aberfeldy. There was a big hype for another Scottish band called Franz Ferdinand, and everybody who liked Franz Ferdinand, I would say to them, no, that's not the Scottish band you should like. It's this other band called Aberfeldy. So in the interest of promoting their career more, I'd really like to play a song of theirs called Slow Me Down.
That's Aberfeldy, and with me is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're reviewing the year in pop music. And Ken, I think this is the moment we've all been waiting for, the dramatic and stirring reading of your 10 best CDs of the year.
Well, thank you. Let me preface it by saying this is probably the last year I would ever compile a list of albums. I think that the music scene has become so fragmented that it's so much of an iPod culture, downloading of specific songs, that I think in the future I'll be thinking much more in terms of the way a lot of people listen to their music, which is kind of individual songs, moments, perhaps a song performed on television. But so this adds a layer, a misty layer of nostalgia, I think, to the reading of the list this year.
Well, you just said songs performed on television. I think what you're saying here, too, is that people are finding music differently than they used to.
They are. I mean, you know, it's like I'm not ashamed to say that I watch The O.C. every week, and that people watch The O.C., listen to the music that's played on that, and then stay through the closing credits because they tell you what songs, what albums were played in that episode of The O.C. So it's another form of marketing. And, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been seen as a complete sellout. And now bands, completely respectable, credible indie bands like The Shins, get a lot more airplay, a lot more notice than they ever would by agreeing to appear or be played on a television show.
Does that say something about the state of radio?
It does say a lot about how limiting radio is and how these bands have to find any way possible to get their music out there, and listeners recognize that.
Okay, so here's the moment.
Okay.
The moment we've been waiting for.
It's almost going to be anticlimactic, isn't it? My favorite album of the year was Eagles of Death Metal's Peace, Love, Death Metal. Number two was Brian Wilson Presents Smile. Number three was that band from Cincinnati I talked about called the Black Keys and their album Rubber Factory. Number four is Green Day's American Idiot. Number five is Nellie Mackay's double album called Get Away From Me. Number six is a fairly recent release by Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, a really terrific old-fashioned rock and roll album called Shake the Sheets. They're from North Jersey. Number seven is Ludacris, Bill O'Reilly's Bette Noire, and his album Red Light District. It's a really, really funny, bragging album. Talks about, you know, how many albums he's sold right in the first track. He's really funny. Number eight is Tegan and Sarah's album So Jealous. Number nine is that Scottish band I mentioned, Aberfeldy's album called Young Forever. And number 10 is this very young, eccentric, young artist named Jolie Holland, who plays a piano and ukulele on a wonderful album called Escondida. So that's the 10.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ken. And you should choose something for us to go out with.
Yeah, I think I'd really like to go out on Jolie Holland and her song Sasha.
All right. Well, happy holidays.
Same to you. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic.
Tonight, my heart is full of a sad song. My lonesome lover has taken off. I'm wandering around on a cloud, empty-hearted and down and out. It's been a week, I think, since he rolled into town, and it's been years that I've heard these stories about this fella. He's so brave and so alive, turning this world around from the out to the inside.
Coming up, the first season of the HBO series The Wire is out on DVD, and critic John Powers has a review. This is Fresh Air. The much-acclaimed TV show The Wire just ended its third season. A new 5-DVD set of the first season is now out from HBO. Critic John Power says the series reminds him of an older kind of storytelling.
Back in the 19th century, novels were published in serial form. It's said that the books of Charles Dickens were so popular that throngs would wait at the New York docks for the latest installment of Bleak House or some other sprawling saga about the vast panorama of Victorian society. It's hard to imagine any novel producing that kind of excitement in 21st century America. But for the last 3 years, friends of mine have been reacting like Dickens's readers to HBO's Baltimore-based crime series, The Wire. They race home to see it on Sunday nights, then spend Monday telling me it's the best show on TV. You can't just watch one episode, they always say. You have to see a whole season. I never got around to doing that until a couple of weeks ago, when I finally caught up with The Wire's first year on DVD. And you know what? I went through all 13 hours as fast as I could pop the discs into my player. Thank heavens I didn't have to wait at the docks. The story begins with Baltimore homicide detective Jimmy McNulty watching an obviously guilty drug dealer named D'Angelo Barksdale be acquitted of murder. The furious McNulty runs to a local judge, grumbling that the police are ignoring the Barksdale clan's enormous drug operation in the housing projects. And soon we're following an investigation by a racially mixed band of cops who are etched with the vividness of Daumier. There's the idealistic lesbian, the tightly wound careerist lieutenant, and the inept son-in-law of a departmental bigshot. The criminals they're investigating are equally well-drawn, be it the Barksdale gang's ruthless leaders, a righteous killer who lives by ripping off drug dealers, or D'Angelo Barksdale, who thinks the family business is hell, but just doesn't know how to escape. For much of the series, the cops and the crooks move along parallel tracks. But occasionally they intersect, as when McNulty and his partner, Bunk, bring in D'Angelo to question him about a murder.
We've been in here a whole 2 hours telling you what's true in the world, and you're gonna sit there like nothing happened?
Where my lawyer at?
We called him. When he gets here, we'll let you know.
I got nothing to say. I mean, I'm sorry for the man, but I ain't got nothing to say.
You sorry? You sorry for him? You f***ing killed the man.
No.
Yes, you did. I mean, we don't think that you, shot him or anything. But if you weren't so busy lighting folks up in high-rise lobby, he ain't coming out of the elevator and seeing it happen.
You don't see anything. He doesn't testify. He doesn't testify. Those kids have still got a daddy to lean on.
But why he testify?
How the f*** should we know?
Well, he ain't had to testify.
No, he didn't, but he did. And you still beat the charge, didn't you?
Yeah, but that wasn't enough, was it? Not enough to beat the murder. They gotta send a cold message to everyone in the terrace.
The working man. His kids, that don't count.
The Wire was created by David Simon, a one-time crime reporter who anchors the series in the often undramatic realities of police procedure and routine crime. Where a normal cop show races along, it has to tie up everything neatly in less than an hour, Simon's program has a scope that even movie directors would envy. The series takes its sweet time, making room for the exploration of character, be it the silliness of McNulty and Bunk's horseplay, or the superbly written scene where D'Angelo teaches two young dealers to play chess, a bitter lesson to his troops that they're actually pawns in the great game between the police and their own bosses. Because it spans 13 whole episodes on a single investigation, The Wire does something you almost never see. It captures the daily realities of the workplace, with its petty rivalries, bureaucratic frustrations, and range of social types. McNulty is surrounded by all kinds of officers. Cops who are drunks, cops who are clock punchers, cops who are in-house politicians, even cops who are crooks. And the drug trade is no different. It's a job, too. There are dealers who are junkies, dealers who are clock punchers, dealers who are in-house politicians, and dealers who, despite breaking the law, aren't really crooks. One reason people love those big, fat 19th century novels is that they offer a vision of society that feels comprehensive. They bring together the high and the low. No American program has come closer to doing the same thing than The Wire, which I've heard compared to Dickens and Thackeray, Balzac and Zola. I doubt that Simon's show will be able to claim such a legacy. Pop culture isn't built to last. But it does offer an X-ray portrait of a whole society, from powerful elected officials to scraggly drug addicts. And as the first season progresses, we realize that both the legal society and the illegal society, both McNulty and D'Angelo, are actually mirror images of one another. The kingpins on both sides care about power, the pawns on both sides are expendable, and everyone is caught in a shadowland that's almost a different universe than the reassuring one you find on CSI, where every crime gets solved through the use of high-tech equipment. Here, everyone's working with the low-tech of human fallibility, in which good and evil look mighty gray, and a commissioner of police can have less conscience than a killer.
John Powers is media columnist for LA Weekly and film critic for Vogue.
When you walk through the garden,
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins talks about being embedded with the Marines in Fallujah. He writes, "The battle for Fallujah did not fall into any neat category, and even the messy label of urban warfare did not capture the intensity and unpredictability of this battlefield." I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.